Today we're going to continue what we were doing last week in looking at, shall we say, unusual midrashim. And in last week's shiur, the first half of the shiur really was sort of an introduction to how to study midrash. We talked about how to analyze midrash, the different approaches to studying midrash, and the importance of looking at a midrash and looking inside of it. In other words, starting with the assumption that the Baalei HaMidrash are exactly what we call them, Chachamim, and that the material is profound and deep, but because it's profound and deep, we clearly are not going to assume it on a literal level, especially when it, they should be coming around, on a literal level when it kind of confounds us to read it literally. We can give a couple examples. Today I want to take a look at a particular character who, believe it or not, I think is a little bit unattended to in our study of the Megillah, and that is Achashverosh. Achashverosh is sort of the background of everything, but he doesn't seem to be in the foreground. And looking at the Midrashim, we're going to find, as you see from the title, Achashverosh portrayed in two very opposite, very different, and you might almost think opposite, confrontational modes. I'll explain what I mean by confrontational mode. We have all sorts of characters in Tanakh that, of course, interact, and some of them interact confrontationally, like Yaakov and Esav, or like Lavan and Yaakov, or like Yaakov and his sons. Boy, this is getting boring. Like Moshe and Paro is a classic pairing off. David and Yoav at a particular point, but David and Shaul certainly, is a confrontational mode. There are many, many characters in Tanakh that either do not meet in Tanakh, or else, at least we don't hear about their meeting, or else meet, but the meeting is an innocent meeting. And in the Midrashim, the meetings are turned confrontational. I'll give you two quick examples from material that we're all familiar with. In the early, early parts of Bereshit, we hear about a particular king briefly named Nimrod. And it's a little unclear, but it seems the shading of the Psukim shades him in a negative light. Nimrod comes, Nimrod leaves, and that's the end of that. A while later, we are introduced to, of course, our first hero in Tanakh, which is Avraham. Avraham and Nimrod have nothing to do with each other. However, if you were to look at one of those timeline things, you would see that their lives did overlap. And Nimrod being in the area of Mesopotamia, and Avraham coming from there, so it's not unreasonable that they had a meeting. Nimrod and Avraham in the Midrash are turned into absolute adversaries. Nimrod stands for the power of man. Avraham stands for the power of God. Nimrod becomes, in the Midrash, the one who engineers the building of the tower, which is Naseh Lanu Shem, let's make a name for ourselves. And Avraham becomes the one who is Vayikra B'Shem Hashem. He calls that in God's name. So they're turned into confrontational characters who actually have a direct confrontation. The most famous Midrash about Avraham that we all grew up with, which is Avraham and the baseball bat, ends with, the second half of it is Avraham being dragged by his father to Nimrod, and Nimrod says, you have to worship fire. And Avraham says, well, think about this. Water can douse fire. So Nimrod says, okay, we'll worship water. And then Avraham says, well, the clouds are stronger than water, so we'll worship the clouds. Well, the wind is stronger than the clouds, we'll worship the wind, et cetera, until finally Nimrod, in frustration, says, the hell with that. I worship the fire, you'll worship the fire. Throws Avraham into the fire. Avraham comes out unscathed, which is all there to tell us a story about Haran, who is the real focal point, like sort of the reason for the Midrash. But this confrontation between Avraham and Nimrod also fits something that we talked about last week. It is absolutely anachronistic, meaning it's portrayed, it's Avraham and Nimrod, which is before the middle, the meaning of the first half of the second millennium BCE, but their conversation and the results of their conversation are totally Greek. The idea that you could use an argument in order to convince somebody what theology they should adopt, and that they'll actually switch theologies based on that. So, okay, you're right, we'll worship water because water is stronger than fire. Because remember, Midrashim are speaking to an audience, and we have to know who the audience is in order to understand what the significance of the Midrash is. But point is that Nimrod and Avraham are turned into adversaries, which doesn't happen in the text. Another classical example of this is a different kind of adversarial relationship, and that is people who really never meet, but are presented as apposites and apposition, which is Bilam and Avraham. And that's famous in the Mishnah, three midot of Bilam, the opposite of Avraham, etc. And so you have to wonder why that is. So I gave a hint in the presentation of Nimrod. And this is a key to understanding Midrashim, is that all Midrashim are anchored in Psukim, which means, that's what a Midrash means. Midrash is seeking more information from text. Sometimes you will have half a phrase from a Pasuk and then a long Agadah. Most of it's Agadah. Most of it's not Midrash, meaning very little of it is actually commenting on the text. But the part that's commenting on the text is commenting on a text. Which means the first question you got to ask when studying a midrash is, how does this midrash come from that text? And it does, but sometimes you got to search. Sometimes you got to look around for allusions in the text itself to other texts to create that association. But a midrash is operating from a text. The second question you got to ask, which is perhaps more critical, is what is the midrash trying to convey? It's certainly not trying to convey, yeah, the text is saying what the text is saying. It's trying to say something more than the text and trying to convey a message, a lesson, an idea, a hashkafa, if you will. And neither one of those is overt in the text, in the Midrash, sorry. Neither one of them is overt. Midrashei Agadah do not engage in what Midrash Halacha engages in, which is to say, here's a gzerah shavah, here's a phrase here, here's a phrase there, so you put it together, and we find that Abraham was opposite Nimrod. It'll just tell you the story. Abraham was dragged to Nimrod and had this confrontation, and he was thrown into the fire, etc. The second thing is that the lesson that it's trying to present is also usually not presented in Midrash explicitly. And there are reasons that go on kind of both ends of the spectrum for both of those things. The reason for the method by which the text leads to that Midrash not being in the Midrash is because Midrashim were typically presented publicly and not in a strict academic environment. So it would both be kind of digressive, and it also may have been beyond much of the audience. The reason that the lesson may not be overtly there, in some cases it is also because the lesson really is something that can refract and play out differently for different people in different generations. And remember, the Midrashim that we're reading are Midrashim that were repeated over generations. That's how they made the cut. In other words, we read Midrashim in an 8th century collection with names from the 3rd century. That means they've been repeated over and over because they were so they resonated so well. There was this depth of truth to them. And that means that in every generation, in every setting, whether in Babel, in Tveria, in Roman Tveria, in Byzantium Tveria, in Mamluk Eretz Yisrael, they played it with a different message. So you got to kind of dig and try to figure out what the message may have been, or any of those messages may have been. Yeah, Jason.
Where did they get this idea from? Couldn't they borrow it?
What, Midrash?
Like getting characters to me that are in different time periods and things like that.
Oh, well, actually, all of it's, by the way, in Tanakh. You find Midrashim in Tanakh, and you find characters brought together in Tanakh. And I'll give you one example. If you look at Yechezkel, Yodalad, Yodalad. Yechezkel there in that passage is talking about people who were righteous but were unable to save anyone except themselves. And he mentions Noach and Eov and a particular character named Daniel. Our text fixes it to Daniel, but it doesn't seem to fit. Daniel seems to be a character from Ugaritic epics, but who were like righteous people who were able to be saved themselves, but not others, which means he's bringing people together from different generations, some of them who may have existed, may not have existed. I mean, Eov is a big machlok, could have existed. Bring them together into kind of one passage to show some sort of similarity. So that's not at all ungrounded. Midrashim in Tanakh, you find lots of. You find even Midrashim in Devarim on things in earlier parts of Chumash. And you find Midrashim, for instance, the play on Bilam's bracha that shows up in Yirmiyahu's curse of Moab. He's almost word for word. He's playing with the words and applying it to her circumstance.
But I mean, were there other people that were telling stories in the same way?
Telling stories is not what Midrashim are. It's important to note. Agadot is telling stories.
Right.
Midrashim is taking a text, a sanctified text, and getting additional lessons from it and maybe weaving it into an Agadah. That's a separate thing. Talk about the Midrash itself.
I just call it straight thumb because you're still... telling a story from the text, and the text is the foundation of what.
Right. So very likely there you find parallel things in the Hellenistic world. But remember, it predates our interaction with Hellenism, right? Unlike if you ask me about Gematria, I'd say Gematria is straight up borrowed from the Greeks, and you know, we have no such thing before the Greeks. I get it, but we're talking about this. This is something that really goes back to Tanakh itself. All right, so I want to take a look at two Midrashim, and you'll be very surprised. Please don't turn the page over yet. By the way, in high school it usually works. They actually turn it over, but please don't, because you'll be very surprised where the second selection is going to come from. But I want to take a look at the first, this Midrash, which is in Esther Rabbah. Again, Esther Rabbah is like a 9th or 10th century collection of Midrashim, but many of them are much older. It's an Eretz Yisrael collection. We've seen it in the past in the context of a couple of shiurim I gave about comparing how Eretz Yisrael and Bavel looked at the story of Esther and the propriety of certain behavior, etc. But now let's take a look at this. This is a Midrash which seems gratuitous. It seems to be taking a shot at Achashverosh, which is absolutely unnecessary in the text. At the end of the description of the party, part of the party, before the Vashti episode, we hear that Achashverosh directed his butlers to give everybody whatever they wanted. Kichen tziva hamelech al kol rav beto la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish. Simple reader, that means that the butlers were told to give everybody what they wanted. So you want a lot of wine, you want a little bit of wine. You don't want to drink wine. You want red wine, you want white wine. You want wine from your country, you want wine dafka from Shushan. Whatever you want, up to you. It's the simplest thing in the world, and it's, by the way, what every one of us engages in when serving drinks at our house on Friday night. You want some wine, you want grape juice, you want some schnapps. You know, if you have it, you offer people choices. There's nothing weird about this. Look what the Midrash does. I mean, I was looking at this yesterday. I was like, whoa, this is such a bizarre statement. Take a look. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, what does Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu mean? God said to Achashverosh. Now, in Midrashim, all sorts of interactions happen, which we do not believe literally are going to happen. We will never think that Achashverosh is a Navi, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to him. Right? We also don't think that birds talk and that foxes talk to fish and have conversations. We understand that that those aren't to be taken literally. But here, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, if you don't read the word lo, it becomes a little easier. But ani eni yotzei midei briyotai. I can't satisfy everybody. And you want to satisfy everybody? Now, what? I don't understand. What's wrong with trying to make everybody happy at the meal? Now, watch how the Midrash picks on him. And this is God talking to Achashverosh in this Midrash. But noag sheba olam, the normal way of the world is, shnei bnei adam vakshim lisa isha achat. Two guys want to marry one girl, right? Yicholahi l'nasei l'shneyam, could she marry both? Ela olazeh. Well, make a choice. Marry this guy, marry that guy. All right, unless you're Rav Chisa's daughter, which you do one after the other. So now you have two boats that are out at sea. So the two boats are sort of in the same channel. One wants to go to the south, one wants to go to the north, and they want winds because the only boats they had were sailboats. All right. Now this is not the same, because a woman can only marry one man. But the wind could blow, let's say, east, you know, and then they could go further out, and then they could be far enough away that you could have two winds. It could happen. But nonetheless, you can't simultaneously have a north and south wind. Where's this Midrash leading? Watch this. Tomorrow, you're going to have two people come before you. Now, tomorrow means sometime in the near future, there are going to be two people which, in the eyes of this Midrash, are people that Achashverosh has not yet interacted with. Other Midrashim, and including one we're going to see soon, have both Mordechai and Haman in different contexts be actively involved in Achashverosh's rule from the beginning and even from before that. Right? But here you're going to have Bayim Lefanecha B'din. Ish Yehudi V'ish Tsar V'Oyev. Just come and stack in the deck. A Yehudi, and one we don't like, right? Yechol atah latzeit yidei shnehem. Can you possibly help both of them? Can you possibly take care of both of them? Ela she'atam romem lezev et solev lezev. You're going to elevate one, and you're going to, and by the way, remember, we saw this in Midrashei Eretz Yisrael Dafka, and by the way, remember, the Midrashei Eretz Yisrael are interacting with Christianity, and they continually use the word solev, which means to crucify, when they talk about Haman. Midrashim always use that word. I mentioned to you that in the 4th century, in Rome, the city passed an edict. The Jews were not allowed to celebrate Purim publicly because they were actually burning Haman in effigy, but on a cross. Right? A lot of interesting stuff. Read Horowitz's books on reckless rites. Anyhow, Rav Huna b'shem Rav Binyamin bar Levi amar lefisha b'olam hazeh b'zman shorach tzfonim nashevet and ruach dromit nashevet. There's another formulation of the same thing. North wind, there's no south wind. That's the way the world works, but it's God's world. I'm going to bring a magical wind that actually works in both directions, and then he brings the pasuk from Yeshayahu to bring the north wind and the south wind and bring the Jews from everywhere to Eretz Israel. Now, back to our topic. Etc. But what's the upshot of the Midrash? God is saying to Achashverosh, you chutzpinyak, you arrogant guy, you think that you can somehow satisfy two opposite people? Well, the answer is, yeah, of course. I'll give him red wine, give him white wine. What's the problem? Which is the Midrash is deliberately creating a position on Achashverosh's part, which is nowhere there, and which is a fully innocent and quite proper hosting. So we've got to ask two questions, the same two questions you always got to ask in a Midrash. Where is it coming from and where is it going? What's the source for this and what's the lesson? Right? So, I think a few years ago I introduced you to Chuck. I'll reintroduce you to Chuck in case you forgot. Chuck is a good old boy. Chuck lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Among his friends, he's considered an intellectual because he once read a book. Chuck ends up one day, he's a traveling salesman, he ends up one day in the Motel 6 in Enid, Oklahoma, locked into his motel room because of a twister, and as a result, the electricity's out, there's no cable. Chuck is bored. So Chuck takes out his pen light that he has on his keys, turns it on, and sees that the Gideon Society left him a nice little gift. Right? It's not a Marriott, so there's no Book of Mormon, there's just a Bible. He opens it up, flips through, and before he gets to the New Testament, he flips through and sees a book called Esther. And he reads the book of Esther about Ahasuerus and about Haman and about names that even he can't pronounce. And it's a cute story. Chuck understands the story, and it, by the way, ties up very neatly at the end. Very nice story that Chuck reads on this level. However, we are supposed to read Megillah on Chuck's level and on a deeper level and on a deeper level and a yet deeper level. I'm not talking about anything mystical. When you read the Megillah in the original within the context of Tanakh, there are so many messages that Chuck will never get, and we don't want him to get, because the message is for us. And by the way, most of them are not positive messages. The Megillah on the surface is a burlesque. It's hilarious. And underneath it, there is stinging criticism, and the stinging criticism is really aimed at two directions. One is the court, Persian specifically, human in general, and on the other hand, to the Jews. To the Jews who did not heed the call to go back to Eretz Israel and build, but stayed back and took names like Mordechai and Esther, etc. And we all know about the assimilation that was going on, that maybe this was a little bit of a stop in that. How do we see this in the Megillah? So if you take a look, some of this is old material for us, but it's looking at it from a fresh light. If you look in Source 2, we all know Source 2, the first two psukim in the Megillah, and we're told by Amimahem Keshevet HaMelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Malchuto, where is his great throne? Asher B'Shushan HaBira. Now, if you ask somebody, anybody on the street, what is the most famous Bira in Tanakh, they will answer like this, Shushan HaBira. But if you ask somebody who really knows Tanakh, especially of the Persian period, this is the Persian period, they'll tell you, I'll tell you what the Bira is. Take a look in Divrei Hayamim Aleph Chavtet, Source 3. And this is where David is charging Shlomo. It doesn't happen in Shmuel or Malachim. But in Divrei Hayamim, David appoints Shlomo to take over for him while David's alive and healthy, unlike the story we read in Malachim. And he charges Shlomo with the mission of building the Beit HaMikdash. And he appoints all of the people who are going to help him and does all of this publicly so everybody knows Shlomo's in charge. And all the preparations, he appoints the Levi'im who are going to compose the music, sets everything up in advance. Right? Because Hashem told him that you won't build it, your son will build it. His name will be Shlomo, Shalom Yam Yamav, which of course is also in Divrei Hayamim only. Watch what David says. Vayomer David HaMelech l'chol ha'kahal, Shlomo v'ni echad b'char bo Elohim na'ar varach. Hashem chose my son Shlomo, this young man, v'hamlacha gdola, there's a lot of work, but he's telling all of the people around, they got to help him. Ki lo la'adam ha'bira, ki la'adonai Elohim. Who has to build the bira? And who does the bira belong to? It belongs to God, so it's a tremendous job, you all need to help. What's the bira? The Beit HaMikdash. So since the bira is the Beit HaMikdash, and then I look at Esther, and which happens obviously later, right? I look at Esther, although the Rambam is composed later, perhaps. But I read Esther, and I take a look at it, and it says, Shushana bira? What kind of chutzpah is that? How the heck do you call Shushana bira when your bira is Beit HaMikdash?
And it's
Habira. So now I'm starting to get a picture. We're all familiar with the Midrashim of Chazal, associating the feast of Achashverosh with Big Day Kuhuna, Achashverosh putting on Big Day Kuhuna, which we get from the allusions in the text that Chuck will never get, and we don't want him to get. Tchelet, Argaman, Kavod, Tiferet, all those keywords that Chazal pick up in the Midrashim and tell us that about the Big Day Kuhuna, etc. I'll give you another example, because remember, part of the Megillah's agenda is to needle at human courts in general and the Persian court specifically. And one of the ways it does it is by raising the profile of the protocol of the court. The word for protocol in Persian is dat. And so that then comes into Hebrew and changes meanings about four times till today. But in the original, in Persian, it means, in ancient Farsi, it means protocol, court protocol. The word dat shows up 22 times in the Megillah. All sorts of protocols. Remember what the first protocol is. The first protocol is about drinking. And the protocol is, there's no rules. It's kind of like a piece out of Monty Python. Right? The first rule is, there's no rules. And the interesting thing is that that's another piece of the stinging. You're filled with rules. Your rules about things like drinking. And what are your rules? There's no rules. There's a lot of stinging there. Now, of course, Chuck wouldn't get that. But again, we don't want him to. Take a look at Esther Dalid. And you contrast Esther Dalid with Sefer Bamidbar, because it's a deliberate contrast. This is when Esther sends her refusal to Mordechai, when she refuses to go in to see Achashverosh. She says, we all know, everybody knows, that you're not allowed to go to the king. Anybody who comes into the inner chambers without being summoned immediately dies. Does that remind you of something in Halacha? Certainly does. Anybody who's Tameh walks in the Mikdash. It's Chayav Mitah, right? Mitah B'dei Shamayim. Except for this. Levad mi'asher yoshit lo melech chavit azav v'chaya. Unless the king's in a mood. They have very strict rules. You walk in without being summoned, you die. Unless you don't. Compare that, contrast that with Bamidbar. And Chazal have a comment on this. Hazar karev yumat, a foreigner, whatever foreigner is, means non-Kohen Gadol, non-Kohen, non-Levi, etc. Karev yumat, Then no exception. So the Gemara famously says that when the famous story about the three Gerim that go to Shammai and then Hillel, right? So one, well, the famous one is of course the one-legged guy, but the one of the other ones is he goes and says, I wanna become Jewish on condition you make me Kohen Gadol. So Shammai throws him out, and Hillel says, fine, come sit down. So he says, you know what? You're gonna be Kohen Gadol. Let's learn some of the rules, right? Okay, let's talk about the Mikdash. Hazara Karev Yumat. And the convert says, who's that talking about? It's even David HaMelech. Really? And the guy converts as a convert, not as a Kohen Gadol. He gets it. But point is, Hazar Karev Yumat doesn't make exceptions. Say, well, it was raining. I had to go inside. You know? I was really feeling spiritual. I just come back from Oman, so I went inside. I mean, it does no such thing. As opposed to Achashverosh. So what picture are we getting from here? Well, we're getting a picture that's maybe a little unfair to Achashverosh because it's really aimed at the Jews and the way that they're relating to Achashverosh. They're accepting a semi-deity, which the Persian kings were, Melech HaMlachim, a man you're not allowed to see, he's behind the curtain. And they're accepting him instead of course, going to Jerusalem to build the Mikdash or to participate in the recently built Mikdash. But the Achashverosh then makes for us a very convenient vehicle for poking, and Achashverosh now becomes the guy who's trying to challenge God. And so la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish, an absolutely innocent statement, becomes an opportunity for us, and that becomes both where from and where to. La'asot kirtzon ish va'ish becomes a vehicle for us to come in and say, you human king, you're trying to satisfy everybody? Even God can't satisfy everybody. You're trying to be greater than God? Can't be done. And you see from this psukim where it's coming from, and then la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish becomes sort of the anchor that we rely on, the shelf that we lean on for this. And the lesson becomes a very powerful lesson, which is human beings have hubris, and the greater they are, the greater their hubris, and the more they think they can control things. And people who really aren't put in some sort of control ultimately think that they can control everything, right? So that's piece one. Now, piece two, okay, turn the page, and you can find something surprising here. What we're looking at is a passage from the Septuagint. A Septuagint, as you all know, is the Greek translation of the Tanakh that was done by the community in Alexandria. The Chumash, according to tradition, was translated at the directive of Ptolemy Philadelphus IV in around the year 240 BCE, but the rest of the Tanakh was translated by commission by the Alexandrian community, because they didn't speak Hebrew. Matter of fact, all the evidence we have is that even Philo, the great Philo, didn't speak Hebrew. And that all of his great Midrashe Pilon, were all actually based on a Greek translation of Chumash, which is Chaval. But the Septuagint almost always is a loyal translation of the text, with interesting variations, and there are people who have made a career of some Septuagint studies of identifying why these particular changes are there, changes in numbers, changes in sequence, changes of names, etc. But they're usually relatively minor. The one huge exception to that rule is Megillat Esther. If I were to ask you, what is the oddest thing about Megillat Esther being in Tanakh, what would you answer right away? The oddest thing, the thing that makes it odd that Esther's in Tanakh. God's name is not there. Very famous. It's one of the two books in Tanakh where God's name is not there, but the other one's filled with hints to God. God's not there. But interesting is that if you open up the Septuagint, you will see that there are three very big additions to the story of Esther. One in the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end. And all of them got all over the place. It starts with Mordechai having a dream, and in a dream he sees a threat coming, and God speaks to him and tells him to get ready for this threat, etc. In the middle, there's a tefillah of Mordechai and Esther to God, and then at the end, it's all... Anyways, the reason I'm bringing this up is because whether or not, and this is a huge issue in Septuagint studies, is the text of the Septuagint operating from a different Tanakh, where the variations in numbers, like in Shoftim Chaf, are really based on a slightly different text, what we call a different vorlage, or is the Septuagint commenting on, sort of writing its own midrash to enhance the text? Right? And that's an interesting question to deal with. It sort of doesn't matter for us, because if you read something in the Septuagint that's vastly different than what we have in our text, it means that's how that community understood the story. Whether or not they said that's what the original story said, or that that's the midrashic development of the story. Okay, good. So let's look at the critical piece, from the Septuagint. I have the English translation on the side. Notice Mordechai is called Mardochius. All right, Bigtan and Teresh are Gabatha and Thara, and you don't want them for your son-in-law in any case. Doesn't matter what their name is. And Haman is Amman, right? Correct. And I bolded him in Greek because I wanted to show you his presence in the story. This is the story of Bigtan and Teresh. Parenthetically, this story is presented in the Septuagint at the beginning of the story, not after Achashverosh's feast and after Vashti being ousted and after a new queen is chosen, but rather at the very beginning of the story. It's a wild thing on its own to just look through the Septuagint and the differences. If anybody's interested, well, there's online you could see it, but Levinson's Esther commentary, I think for OTL, has all of the additions in it and comments about them. Okay, so now in English, And Mordechai, I'm going to say the names of the women, rested quiet in the palace with Bigthan and Teresh, the king's two chamberlains, Wilt and whoever else, eunuchs who guarded the palace. Sorry. And he heard their reasonings and searched out their plans and learned that they were preparing to lay hands on the king. Here, by the way, the king is not Xerxes, but Artaxasta, meaning that it's later than Xerxes, the one that the Greeks have. And he informed the king concerning them, and the king examined the two chamberlains, and they were confessed, and they were executed. All right, that's exactly like what we heard. Okay, and the king wrote these things for memorial. Also, Mordechai wrote concerning these matters. Okay, so we know it's in Divrei Hayamim. We didn't know that Mordechai also kept a diary, but it's in there. And the king commanded Mordechai to attend in the palace and gave him gifts for the service. By the way, that means from the very beginning of the story, Mordechai is now in the palace. Okay, and Haman, the son of Hamdata, the Bugian, right? Guess he was into 50s music. Was honorable in the sight of the king. It should be the king.
Is that supposed to be Agagi?
What? Yeah, but they don't read it Agagi. And he endeavored to hurt Mordechai and his people because of the two chamberlains of the king. Now, this comment takes a very different direction because it means that that Haman's hatred for Mordechai is not grounded in Mordechai's refusal to bow. It's not grounded in the Agadah of Haman selling himself as a slave to Mordechai and being angry about that, but it's because Haman thwarted the plan to kill the king. What does that tell you about Haman? Haman was behind the plan.
Mordechai
thwarted the plan. Haman hates Mordechai because of that. What does that tell you about Haman? That Haman's behind the plan to kill the king.
But if he was jealous.
Now, if you read through the Megillah, you really don't see anything of that sort, that Haman wants to kill the king. If you read it like Chuck, certainly, Haman seems to be a loyal advisor who's just got his own plans, trying to operate kind of on the side, run his own little business on the side of killing Jews, but not that he's trying to kill the king. So it seems to come out of nowhere. Now, whether or not we read this as a different forlage, or much more likely as some sort of midrashic development, it means these are midrashim that are alive. By the way, it's important to note, in the history of midrashim keep resurfacing. So, for instance, just a quick example, something we did years ago here, is that in the scrolls texts, one of the types of texts that we find are Midrashim. All right, so this goes back now to 2nd century BCE. There's a very famous text called the Genesis Apocryphon, which is a Midrash on Bereishit, and we only have a tiny fragment of it. And in the Genesis Apocryphon, you have a story that Avram comes to Egypt, that piece, and that Avram had a dream. And in the dream, he saw a cedar tree and a palm tree whose roots were intertwined. And people came to cut down the date tree, the palm tree, and the palm tree said, "Don't cut me down, because if you cut me down, the cedar tree will die." Avram woke up and he said to someone, "Hey, you better tell them you're my sister." So that's where the whole idea came. Beautiful. 600 years later, open up Midrash Bereishit Rabbah, and Bereishit Rabbah on the parsha of Paro and Sarah starts with a pasuk, Tzadik katamar yifrach ke'erez bal vanon yisgeh. What do we know about an erez and a tamar? Anybody who climbs to the top of them endangers his life. Paro tried to attack Amon Sarah, and look what happened to him. Whoa! Because the Midrashim keep staying, and they may shift. But like there's this erez and tamar and protection, etc., that motif continues. So it wouldn't be surprising to find that this will be found from the 3rd century BCE in Alexandria reappears. Take a look at this. Balailahu nadinashnat hamelech. Right? Very famous Brahms lullaby. King couldn't sleep. Naddu shamayim. So one of the midrashim is that the heavens are not able to sleep. Kiso shamelech machem lachim. Whose throne was it that was shaking? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sharat Yisrael bitzara. The only problem with that is that implies that God normally sleeps, but tonight he couldn't sleep. V'chiyesh sheina lifnei makom v'alokvar ne'mar hinein lo yanum v'lo inshan shomei Yisrael. Right? Ela, it means as follows. Bizman Yisrael shuriyin bitzara v'moto olam b'shava. When we're in trouble and they're having good time, from our perspective, it seems like God's sleeping. That's why I have a pasuk that says, "Wake up, God." That's the famous Ma'orin that we talked, the Orin that Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Now, let's see the other piece. So that's God's sleep. God can't sleep. Now, the other one, and by the way, in all the Midrashim, they offer both choices, that the king is Hashem and the king is Achashverosh. In that case, what did he see? He had a dream that night. What was the dream? Shenatal sayaf lahargo. And Haman took a sword, was going to come in and behead him. V'nivhal, he shook and he woke up. V'hikitz mishnato, woke up from his sleep, and now he couldn't sleep. V'amar l'sofram v'hiviyu sefer zichronot likrot v'lirot mashavar alav. That's why he brought the Chronicles, because he wants to find, is there a history behind this that his closest advisor would want to kill him? She found indeed it was true that years ago there had been two chamberlains who tried to kill him, so his own close people were trying to kill him. And by the way, Mordechai saved him. Which, by the way, turns our perception of the story inside out, because we think the main point of the story is to find Mordechai's name. No, it's actually to find Bigdan and Teresh in there. Okay? And then who shows up at that moment to talk to the king in the middle of the night? Haman. What's Haman coming for? He's coming to ask Achashverosh to put Mordechai up. The king doesn't know that. He just had a dream that Haman's going to come to him in his bed and kill him. And now he's in his bed, and suddenly in the middle of the night, Haman's there. So now what happens? Amar Melech, my dream was right. He must be coming here to kill me. Which is why the king traps him by saying, what should I do for somebody I really want to honor, knowing Haman will think it's him? And Haman describes his own coronation, and basically Haman has just been hoisted by his own petard. It's great. But notice that what the Septuagint on one hand and what this much later Midrash have in common is a notion that Haman is not an advisor to the king who's just running his own little thing on the side. He's a pretender to the throne. And he's somebody who actively is trying to get the king killed. Okay. Where does that come from? I will leave you with the last question, which is, what's the teaching? Well, maybe a lot of ways to go with that. But where does it come from? Because you got to start with that. A midrash is not just out of nowhere. You got to look at the text, but you got to look at the whole text, not just the words they're quoting, the whole picture. Okay. Start with this. The famous decree to bow to Haman. I want you to think about what that means. There is a decree that all members of the court bow to Haman. As I mentioned a couple years ago, there is no way in the world the king signs off on a decree like that. To have people bow to an underling of the king is actually treason to the king. So Haman has to be operating with the notion, which the Megillah totally supports, that the king is oblivious to stuff happening outside. So why is he getting people to bow to him? He's trying to create a loyalty among them for when he overthrows. But you see it further when the king summons Haman in, when Haman wants to come into him, and the king cleverly asks him, what should I do for somebody I want to honor, and what does the Haman describe? A coronation. So interesting, what happens at the end for Haman, at the second party? The king comes out to Esther and says, what do you want? She says, save me, my people, right? Who is it? Haman. Right? And then immediately Haman freaks out. The king walks out, comes back in, where's Haman? Lying on top of Esther, which he's doing one of two things, neither which is very good. The king uses an interesting phrase. Hagam lichbosh et hamalkah imi bavayit? What does that mean? You want to take my queen in my own house? Which means, what does the king see in Haman? A pretender to the throne, somebody trying to kill me and take my queen. Either kill her also, or take her as a wife. The interesting thing is, Harvona comes and speaks up. And what does Harvona say? Oh, by the way, your majesty, this Haman, who's a traitor, set up a tree in his backyard to kill Mordechai, your friend. And the king's reaction, the response is obvious. So put him up there. Parenthetically, what's the punishment for treason in the Persian Empire? So if you look in Ezra Perek Dalet, you'll see that the punishment for treason in the Persian Empire is that a tree is set up in your backyard and you are impaled on it. Which means Haman ends up exactly how he's supposed to end up. There's a delightful midrash that we saw, I think, 2 years ago here, that Haman was the same size as Mordechai. So he actually got up on the tree to have them measure it. It's a beautiful picture. And by the way, the midrash doesn't call it a tree. It calls it a tzlav. Right? You got to measure right. And so it's like you're looking at the snapshot and say, good, just stay there for a few hours. No reason to move. It's delightful. But notice what the Midrash is doing. The Midrash is simply reading the text carefully and noting that if you look carefully in the text, you will see Haman is not an advisor. He's a traitor. He's trying to kill the king and take over. And therefore, the Midrash expands on it and has him be behind the plot of Bigtan Bateresh. And then that's his anger at Mordechai for thwarting it. And it has him in the later Midrash, Al-Hashirosh, having a dream, which is actually the real dream, that he's coming to kill him. What that particular Midrashic skein is trying to teach, there's a lot of possibilities about, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, a lot of other possible lessons. It also reflects very accurately on the nature of the Persian court that was filled with intrigue and all sorts of problems of that sort. And it could be there's a lot of other things to learn from it. That I'll leave to you. But hopefully we get more insight into the way the Chachamim presented Megillat Esther to us on the full plate.